We'll open up a work session. We have to have a public hearing on House Bill 3163. That's correct. A public hearing on House Bill 3163. Mike Dewey, where are you at? I guess you want to justify.
We'll do this very quickly.
Okay.
Let's see if we get agreement here. Do I have to sit next to Mike?
Well, I don't know. You guys never get along, David. I know.
Chair Nelson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Paulson, Government Affairs Manager for Sprint. Sprint provides local long-distance and wireless service, and in Oregon serves about 79,000 rural access lines. We're here today to support House Bill 3163. It's been a long process in working with the folks in the Building Code Division and others in the industry to come to this, what we think is a very good compromise, which will basically make very clear when electrical permits are needed for installations of telephone service and when they are not. And we've tried very hard to maintain public safety, the safety of our workers, the safety of the public. If we go through barriers to firewall barriers, those types of things, permits will be required. If not, for the most part, for residential and so forth, they will not be required. And so we urge your support of the bill. It's been a long time working with building codes. We appreciate their input and help in doing that, and we're very satisfied with the result and urge its passage today to the Senate, with a due pass.
Thank you, David. Mike?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Mike Dewey, for the record, the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association. You had in your possession at one time Senate Bill 822, which is now moving to the House floor. And, Mr. Chair, you had asked early on in Senate Bill 822 for us to work on some issues on the demarcation point. We were able to do that, but the relating clause was too narrow, and that's what Legislative Council told us. So we had another vehicle in the House, and we used this particular bill to find the particular compromise. So I don't believe there's any opposition to this bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay, sounds very good. I know I just talked with Mark Long, and for the record, he from the Business Bureau, from the department, and he indicated that things were in very good shape. So thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you for your
any questions on this?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to note for the record, first of all, I want to thank Mr. Paulson for not reading any testimony. You've done well. You've been trained well by your predecessor. And I just want to know for the record, there is a statement here from Jenny Lang representing Quest, who anticipates that it will increase costs and create the potential for delays in providing service to customers. But having said that, they are willing to work with the bill, and I appreciate that they're willing to do that. I wanted to recognize their comments.
Thank you.
And I have written testimony for you as well. I'll get to the
okay. He's going to read it right now.
Just for this. Okay. Any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. We don't have anybody else signed up to testify, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3163, open up a work session on House Bill 3163 as amended, and as was indicated by the testimony, this was a companion bill to our Senate Bill 822 that we sent out some time ago. So any further questions on 3163? If not, the chair would move House Bill 3163 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussions? Objections?
Yeah.
So ordered. Since I'm trying to keep up with Senator Walker, I'll carry that. That's a losing cause. I know it's a losing cause. But okay, we'll go back. Sorry, I'll open up a Senate public hearing on Senate Bill 757. Yeah, we've had a public hearing on this, haven't we? Here we have.
Yes, we have.
Okay. Well, we'll. And what do we like here? John in. John Stilts. And you here, sir? Yes. Welcome again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Schiltz. I'm the administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to appear today to request the committee's support for Senate Bill 757 and the Dash 2 amendments. I testified previously, as you probably remember, in some detail about this bill and as well as some background in regard to how the current system for awarding permanent partial disability functions in Oregon. Since that time, we've worked with the Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee, as well as other stakeholders, to amend the bill in a manner that will improve the administration of the permanent partial disability system, as well as changing the way these benefits are distributed. These improvements are in the Dash 2 amendments, which are before you. Permanent partial, just to remind you about this benefit, permanent partial disability benefits compensate injured workers for permanent impairment and loss of earning capacity. In Oregon, the permanent partial disability benefit is a fixed amount that does not adjust annually with the state average weekly wage. Other indemnity benefits tend to adjust annually. The permanent partial disability benefit does pay award currently at unequal rates. Some awards are paid at a single fixed rate that is quite high, and other awards are paid at different rates, which are based upon three different tiers, with higher dollar awards paid for the most serious conditions. About 70% of the awards, however, are paid in the lowest tier only in the current system. And the current permanent partial disability benefit system pays awards that do not have any relationship to the worker's wage. They're not reflective of the worker's wage whatsoever. And we talked about this in some detail previously. What this means for Oregon relative to other states is that our permanent partial disability benefits are relatively high for workers with so-called scheduled injuries, and they're low for most, but not all, workers with unscheduled injuries. When we consider both permanent partial disability and workers' wages together, Oregon is among the most generous states for low-wage workers with scheduled disabilities. But we are also among the least generous states for higher-wage workers with unscheduled disabilities. Considering this issue, this bill is designed to achieve the following goals. The Management Labor Advisory Committee wanted to retain predictable and objective factors for rating disability so that it remains a predictable benefit. They wanted to use wage-based benefits in order to better match compensation that workers lose so they could compensate for their lost earnings. They wanted to simplify the benefit structure. It's a very complex benefit structure currently. They wanted to achieve or maintain or perhaps even exceed parity with benefit generosity of other states when we compare ourselves to other states. And they wanted to continue to encourage return to work as a goal for both workers and employers. Senate Bill 757, as it is amended, achieves these goals. It is structured to be roughly cost neutral. In other words, the total amount of money that's provided to workers for permanent partial disability benefits today would be roughly equal to that in the future. And there are a number of what I consider to be achievements that are in this bill. The bill simplifies the benefit structure tremendously by having only two types of ratings for workers: impairment ratings or impairment modified by work disability factors, which are the worker's age, their education, and their adaptability to a new job. The proposed amendments would use the state average weekly wage to define a minimum and maximum benefit. And this means that these wage-based benefits for the first time in Oregon would adjust annually without having to come to the legislature every 2 years and ask for adjustments. All workers with permanent disability would receive an impairment benefit, which would pay all workers at the same rate, and it would be based on their percentage of disability. Currently, to remind you, our current system pays workers on the impairment rate at four different rates. Workers who are unable to return to work, and I believe, frankly, this is probably the area that's becoming the most controversial part of the bill, workers who are unable to return to regular work would receive a work disability benefit, which would be based on their impairment as modified by their age, their education, and their adaptability, and based on the worker's earnings at the time of injury. Currently, there are some workers who do receive a disability benefit. This benefit would now be extended to all workers who have permanent partial disability who do not return to work. And frankly, all of these factors are highly predictable within the system. So we would have a system that would remain predictable in terms of setting reserves and predicting what the ultimate cost each year would be. The biggest change in the amendments that are before you is that a sunset clause was added to the bill. It greatly lengthens the bill. If the sunset clause is not removed by the legislature in 2007, then the law would revert back to the present system. And I'd also like to mention that our current permanent partial disability benefits have a sunset on them. If this legislature does not take action on the current permanent partial disability benefits, they will sunset back to lower levels.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Schultz, when does that expire, this session?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I'll check and make sure I get this right, but I believe it's at the end of this year. Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that would be on December 31st, 2004.
Okay.
So, excuse me, it's a year and a half away. In summary, this bill shifts the distribution of permanent partial disability awards. With all other things remaining equal, which is a big assumption because things never remain equal, but with all other things remaining equal, what this means is that workers who can't return to work will receive higher awards than those workers who do return to work to their regular jobs. For those workers who can't return to regular work, those who had higher incomes at the time of their injury will receive higher awards than those who had lower incomes at the time of their injury. And the impairment benefit portion of the award will be paid at an equal rate across all types of injuries for the first time in Oregon. In summary, that's the biggest changes that this bill makes. I respectfully request the committee send Senate Bill 757 with its dash two amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And I thank you for your attention. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
You realize there are potentially dash threes that there will be introduced. Have you had a chance to look at the dash threes?
Mr. Chair, I have not yet seen the dash threes. I was told about them today, and I understand that they changed the formula essentially in the work disability portion of the award, that the work disability portion would be based, that award, instead of being based on the workers' wages, would be based on the Oregon average weekly wage, as the impairment portion is also based on that.
And how would there be a huge fiscal impact of that? What's the result of all that?
Mr. Chair, we quickly today anticipated that question and quickly tried to come up with an answer to that, and our rough estimate at this time is that the cost of the workers' compensation system would be approximately $11.5 million more to go to the state average weekly wage than basing that part on the workers' wages. That translates into roughly about a 1.7% projected system loss cost against pure premium. So if all other things remained equal, we would see loss costs going up about 1.7% just based on that change.
And what's the effect of that? Explain that one step further.
The effect of that is that, again, all other things remaining equal,
equal, that pure premium rates would probably have to be adjusted upwards about 1.7% to make up for that loss.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? We'll have the... Why don't you just stay there, John? And Meg, do you want to test?
I'm just making sure John does everything right.
Okay. Senator.
She's got
Senator
a stick behind me.
Okay, you better be real careful, John. Senator Metzger.
Thank you, John. Was there any discussion in working on this in terms of the higher benefits for those who cannot return to work versus those who can return to work? Was there any discussion in terms of that incentive or disincentive, I guess, to struggle to be able to return to work because of the higher benefit level? And if so, what was the nature of that discussion?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, yes, there was discussion about that, and that this benefit package was designed to try to incentivize both employers and workers to return to work, for employers to offer the worker back their regular job. The way this works is it currently there are certain types of injuries where that factor does come into play, but only certain types of injuries. What this would do would be to extend that to all workers who now have permanent partial disability, that if they are unable to return to their regular work, then they would have the work disability benefit added to the award. It provides an incentive for the employer who is trying to manage their costs and trying to manage the cost of their workers' compensation insurance to do everything they can to bring that worker back to their job at injury. It also provides an incentive for the worker to go back to work. If they're released for their regular job and they choose not to go back, then they're not going to get that part of the award. So there is some incentive there as well for the worker. But it's primarily an incentive that's designed to affect the employer's behavior.
Sure. Yeah.
And let's say we enacted this and then the sunset did take effect and it was not renewed or removed at the end of 07. And you've had workers who have been having benefits applied between now and 07, such as you might call it inflation index and other things that have been added to keep these things going. And now if this were to sunset, how would and revert back to the old system, how would those between the time of the enactment of this law and that sunset take effect, how would they be treated? Would their benefits, which have been rolled up in this new system, then go back as if they had been awarded those benefits prior to the enactment of this legislation? Would they be grandfathered into that system because those were the benefits they had been rewarded? And is there a contractual issue with the people between now and the sunset provision that would we have some concern with?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, the permanent partial disability system The benefits that a worker is eligible to receive inside the permanent partial disability system is based on their date of injury. So those workers who would be injured between the date that the act would take effect, the effective date of the act, and then the sunset, would always be eligible for those benefits in that would be provided under this bill. Workers who are injured before or after would be eligible for benefits that would be operational at those dates. Currently, that is the way the law works already. We have traditionally have changed the permanent partial disability benefits every 2 years. We come before the legislature and change the amount of the benefits. So inside of Chapter 656 is currently there are several different benefit types that are listed in there that depend on the date of injury. So in other words, if a worker is injured in 1998, their benefits are actually different from a worker who was injured in 2002, and it's already listed that way. This would just be another difference.
Okay. Thank you.
Just stay right there for a second. Michael, you want to come on up?
Thank you.
And we can talk about the Dash 3 here. We're going to present that to us at some point here.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Slater. I'm the political director of SEIU Local 503, Oregon Public Employees Union. And I'm a little reluctant to oppose this bill because there are many good features to it, particularly the elimination of the difference between scheduled and unscheduled, the elimination of the tiers of awards. I think these are good efforts. In addition, we are concerned about the fact that the previous statute sunsets. We do need a replacement. Having said that, we're still in a position of having to oppose this bill because of the way the benefit award structure, the benefit formula is structured. And our position is that it will, by taking into account injured workers' wages, it will create a significant disparity between workers for the same kind of injury. And I'd like to give you a couple examples. We've had a chance to meet with the department a few times. We've run the numbers ourselves in terms of what the awards would be. And I think it does give us cause for concern. The way the formula is set up right now, there is a floor of 33% of the state average weekly wage and a ceiling of 133% of the state average weekly wage. So if a worker were to have a 10% impairment, they'd be looking at a settlement of about $3,200. A higher wage worker who has the same impairment rating would receive $12,987. So we're seeing a significant difference between workers who could have potentially the exact same injury. And obviously, as we move up in the percentage of impairment, it scales up proportionately so that in a 90% impairment rating, a worker at the bottom end would receive $29,000, and someone with the exact same impairment rating at the high end of the scale would receive about $116,000. From our perspective, and we represent a fair amount of low-wage workers, such as home health care workers who may injure their back or something else and make about $8.40 an hour, that is just too much of a disparity for us to accept in this bill. But again, we recognize that it is an important bill, that it does correct some significant problems with the current system. We'd like to see it move forward, and rather than opposing it, we would propose the Dash 3 amendments, which make one change in the entire bill, and that is in the formula, and use instead of the worker's wage, the state average wage, which in this case is about $650. We recognize there is a small cost to the system. If there are more creative ways to fix this problem, we would be happy to look into those. But as it stands, we just think the disparity is too inequitable.
Thank you.
Mr. Slater, Mr. Chair, could you point to us the only difference between the Dash 3s and the Dash 2s?
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, it is on page 2, and I'm holding the Dash 3s. And it is the formula is calculated starting in lines 19 and continuing through the end of the sentence to line 22. And in this case, the last sentence, the last part at the end of line 21, times 150, the average weekly wage as defined by ORS 656. That is the change, and then it deletes some of the following sentence in the Dash 2 amendments.
So in the Dash 2, you have 133% or no more than 133%?
Correct.
And then in the Dash 3s, you're talking about 150 times.
Oh, no. The 150 times is the multiplier for the award.
Okay. All right. I see that.
That'd be a significant change.
Okay. Senator Walker, further questions?
Yes, I'd ask Mr. Schultz, since you had not seen the Dash 3s and you were making your assumptions based on what you thought the Dash 3 said, is this now what you thought it said? And the things you testified to about the increase to the system, would that still be true?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, yes. This is accurate to what I was told that the Dash 3s would do. And again, it's a rough estimate, but it's the best estimate we could come forward with today. So yes, I wouldn't change my testimony.
Okay, and I have another question, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Mr. Schultz, you indicated that under the Dash 2s, it's cost neutral to the system. It just shifts the payments around among the beneficiaries within it. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, yes. That's correct.
Okay.
Senator Metzger.
Yeah, I'd like to ask the question I asked John earlier. Under the amendments that you propose, I had asked John about the incentives to return to work, and how would you see that issue developing under the Dash 3 amendment, where you'd have some obviously higher paid workers whose benefit would not be as great, and you might call that an incentive to return to work. And those who are lower wage workers and now who have got considerably better benefits than have been working, do you see that as bringing a disparity into the ability to encourage people to go back to work?
Chair Nelson, Senator Metzger, I guess I would acknowledge your point and would argue that it perhaps is just the lesser of the two evils given our concern about the disparity.
Okay, that's fair.
Okay. I have another question.
Sure.
Okay. Mr. Slater, you just had the Dash 3s drafted, I know, because I gave you permission to do that. So you haven't had a chance to take this to MWAC. Have you talked to the parties who are involved in MWAC at all about this, and what's the response?
Chair Nelson, Senator Walker, I have had a brief opportunity to talk with folks at MWAC about this. This bill has appeared a number of times on the MWAC agenda and was not discussed, and I think at the last one I was not able to attend. Perhaps it was addressed at that meeting. My understanding is that that the management representatives to MLAC don't have a position other than their interest in cost neutrality, and that it's some representatives from the building trades on MLAC that is interested in introducing the notion of wages. And at this point, I should point out that MLAC currently doesn't include representation from service, clerical, and professional unions. It represents interests from building trades unions. So we just have a slightly different set of perspectives regarding wage issues.
Is there anybody from MLAC that would like to come up and testify? Sitting out there and clarify some of this. Okay. Look around and say, is there anybody out there? Do a little fishing. Well, welcome, and please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Trussell with Associated Oregon Industries, and I haven't seen the Dash 3 amendments, which I understand they've just become available, and I knew from myself, and I'm not speaking for all my management colleagues on the committee, but I knew that they had a proposal, but I was never sure what the proposal was. So I think we have a meeting on Tuesday, if I am correct, Tuesday morning. So, but I'm interested in looking at the amendments as well.
When you looked at the Dash 2 amendments, what was your response? Have you heard the testimony of both John and Michael here?
I think the Dash 2 amendments are closer to what we were expecting, but I think there'll still need to be some probably technical changes, but we're supportive of the Dash 2s at this point. But MLAC, again, as a committee, has not taken a position on that I, unless they did a polling on a conference
call. On the Dash 3s?
That on the 3s, and I believe that with the 2s, we haven't taken a formal position, but they have polled the members.
Well, we're in this situation where this committee is shutting down today. I guess we could pull this bill back. The other potential is we could push this thing forward, knowing that there's this issue, and get it into the House. So give me some of your reactions to that.
From my perspective, I'd like to see the Dash 2s moved and the bill get started today. But
I mean, potentially, this, if we don't do something today, this bill goes away. I mean, we may not.
And that's a concern, is that we're running out of time. If you guys meet your deadline of where some people think we're going home, we would hate to completely lose the bill. But I'm not comfortable saying I'm okay with the Dash 3s, and I just heard briefly there was a difference on the average weekly wage, and I don't even know enough to speak dangerously of it. So,
do you want to testify? No, right behind Brad.
Mr. Chairman, Brad Witt, MLAC member, also Oregon AFL-CIO. In response to your question, are there any MLAC members in the audience? As much as I would truly like to see the Dash 3 amendments, it would not be in good faith for me at this time to recommend that without my management counterparts having the opportunity to review that. And that's all I wanted the chair to know.
Well, I have the sense for Michael is he feels that he didn't get a voice at some points along in MLAC, and if you've got these dash twos, we're in a situation where we probably should be moving this forward if we can. Michael, do you have some response to that circumstance?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to comment. My organization's position is that we would prefer to see a fix or a negotiated resolution, which we're happy to participate in, before the bill is passed out of committee. I certainly understand, although I realize it's risky, that the committees will be reopened later in the month. I realize you'll probably have a backlog of issues to address there, but I hope that you'd be willing to give us an opportunity to try and negotiate a resolution to this rather than pass it out with the dash twos.
You would have an opportunity to negotiate that as it worked its way through the House. How would you feel about that?
Chair Nelson, again, I just have to restate our position that my organization hopes that we can deal with
this. This bill may go away. I mean, we may not hear it again because this committee is shut down. There's some representation that we may reopen, mm-hmm. but it may not reopen, and then that's it. It's gone.
I understand, Mr. Chair.
I mean, everybody has some good parts of this bill that need to be taken care of. So, what's your sense of this?
Well, Mr. Chair, I understand there are good parts to this bill, and MLEC wants this bill, and I think Mr. Slater wants this bill, but I think he needs to have an opportunity to have his Dash 3s reviewed. Ms. Trussell hasn't said that she doesn't want to look at them. Mr. Witt says he doesn't want to look at them. So, given the fact that you and I are the ones who decide with the president when this committee reopens, I'm in favor of letting him take it to MLAC on Tuesday and reviewing it, and we have the power to bring this back. This committee's not necessarily just shutting down today.
Well, that may or may not be true, because we might have a disagreement within this committee. I mean, we're in a situation where we can move this bill forward. That would be the chair's preference to move it, but it's evidently not your preference.
Senator Metzger?
I share the view of Senator Walker, Senator, Mr. Chairman. I don't have the same concern. I mean, I know in my committee, which is shut down, the two most important bills I haven't seen yet, but I know we will be seeing them, I know we'll be reopening, I'm sure, business and labor in a week as well. I think it is, obviously it's important, but I'd rather have some of these things resolved. And certainly, having just got the Dash 3s myself, and this is a real big issue, and I'd like to have a bit more thoughtfulness on it, especially those eyes on it from both sides, before we move it forward, and at that point would be happy to do so. But I think this is too big to be just kind of guessing, and even in the Dash 2s, in which the MLAC folks haven't been, even voted on it yet, I'd like to have a bit more further review on it before we move on.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Ed Johnson, you have an opportunity. Welcome, sir. Please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon. My name is Edward Johnson from Lincoln County. And I'm partly in favor of the bill and partly against it. As I have testified before, as an injured worker, which I have passed around, my spine is pretty much shot, and I know what it's like.
We've heard your story.
Right.
What about this bill?
When it comes down...
We have lots to do today, so what do you like about the bill? What don't you like?
I would like to see that, let's say if somebody loses their arm or totally disability, it's equal pay across the board. Just because somebody's making $20,000, another person's making $50,000, that is not the basis of what we need. We need something straight across the board so it's even for everybody. Not that one is better treated than another person. And so we cannot do that in our society. And that's what I need to see in that bill to go forward in that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Johnson. I appreciate that. Didn't mean to cut you off, but we've got lots going. It's a Friday afternoon, sir. Thank you. So we'll just shut the public hearing on 7:57 and not go into a work session. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 831. And do we have anybody to testify on 831 here? Yes. Senator Walker, you want to talk about that? We've got the sheet coming up. Do you want to say anything?
I think the parties who have been involved in discussions can come up and talk about.
Okay, we have Charles, is it Kaler? And
Charles C. Kaler.
Charles C. and Jared Bradford.
Mm-hmm.
Please come up. Charles, go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair, committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear. My name is Charles C. Kaler. I'm the manager of the Building Department, LLC, the private concern that does code enforcement for many small jurisdictions in the state of Oregon. Actually, I'd like Mr. Broadfoot to make his point so that I can address them, if that's kosher.
Yeah, I mean, what's, you were working on some amendments, some folks?
Right. Oh, Mr. Chair, thank you. We have worked with the League of Oregon Cities and come up with mutually agreeable wording for an amendment for the bill. Sent it to Senator Walker's office to forward to Legislative Council. They're happy, we're happy.
Those amendments are not available to us yet?
Mm-mm. I have
They're being prepared. Okay.
Yes.
So you're aware of from the testimony of the last committee. Potentially this bill could be heard again, but potentially it could not. So.
Right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jared Broadfoot with PacWest Communications. I'm here today representing the National Electrical Contractors Association and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. We respectfully oppose Senate Bill 831. We have had discussions and have researched this issue. From our perspective, the reason that the third-party inspectors are licensed through the Building Codes Division is that the Building Codes Division pushed through a piece of legislation, I believe in the 99 legislative session, to license them. And we feel that their business licensing through the Building Codes Division allows for oversight and for the Building Codes Division to have more authority over them. If they are not licensed, which this bill seeks to accomplish, the only licensing requirements is that of their individual inspectors. So if our contractors or our workers had problems with any third-party inspector in this state, we would have an avenue to go to the Building Codes Division and to work through through the Building Codes Division and them as a business, instead of having to go after individual inspectors. And frankly, they can replace inspectors if we have problems. And if we have problems with inspectors, they can definitely do that. But if we have a problem with the business, we have an avenue from our contractors to go to the Building Codes Division, and they have authority and oversight. So, like I said, we do oppose Senate Bill 831, and we were unable to come up with any language that would be digestible for our clients. So,
any response,
Chair Nelson? We aren't true third party in the sense of the ORS 455 through point 455. We work as agents of jurisdictions. Let me back up a little bit. The state of Oregon enforces the building codes and delegates to jurisdictions that authority. We work for those jurisdictions, and they do have oversight. Nothing in the licensing that we're asking to be removed from has any kind of regular program evaluations as we are held to as agents of jurisdictions. I believe that as agents, we are held to a higher standard than a true third party would be. The third party that's being referred to that businesses such as ours do not do is we would work for the builder or the developer, that they would work for the builder or the developer of a project or a building. Of course, those folks need, that's sort of like the fox watching the hen house, and those folks need to be regulated somehow, and that licensing would, of course, do that. We don't do that work. Businesses such as ours work only as agents for the cities, and we're doubly looked at. By first of all, we have to please our city. We're masters of we're servants of those masters, as well as Building Codes Division that looks on a regular basis to those jurisdictions to see that those programs are being properly administered. So we have just recently, I just recently went through 14 program evaluations for 14 of our jurisdictions, and we passed with flying colors. And I might say that's not true of all the jurisdictions that are being examined that don't hire agents. We were quite successful, and there are jurisdictions that, again, aren't that hire their own employees, not agents, that don't perform well, that the state has oversight over, and they've had problems with some of it. So our record is very good, but beyond that, there is oversight via BCD. And by the way, we are our inspectors as well. If we didn't have our inspectors, who again are covered by the several ways, we wouldn't be in business. It's not an easy thing to attract and train and continue to keep happy an inspector. They're very highly qualified, highly skilled people. For instance, an electrical inspector has to have 9 years of experience as a journeyman and then a signed supervising electrician before they can sit for the test to be an inspector. And then, again, as agents, they're looked at constantly in program reviews by the Building Codes Division, and if we don't perform well, the cities can fire us. So I believe we are monitored quite well, and I understand why the licensing was there for true third party. That is, those folks that, because a jurisdiction could not in a timely manner do plan review or inspections, then a contractor or developer has a right to hire a third party to do their code enforcement and inspection. As I said, we don't do that work, and I do agree that those folks should be somehow held accountable. We're already held accountable. Businesses such as ours are already. We're not asking to not be held accountable, and we don't believe this legislation does that.
Any response to that?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, briefly, we understand this specific business, and this isn't, our opposition isn't to their specific business, but it's to the bill and what we feel the bill does, and we do not feel that private companies that act as agents should be treated exactly like government entities. They are private entities in themselves, and we don't feel they should be treated exactly like government entities. And I think we heard testimony before, some questions about their E&O insurance as well. So, but like I said, we are opposed to the exemption from the licensing requirements.
Questions? No, thank you. We had a couple of representatives from the city. It seems to me Ralph Broner asked a question of what the cities would do. Is there any representatives from the city would like to come up and speak on this and just further enlighten us?
You always know, Mr. Chair, how the city comes down and cower in the back of the room. Yeah. You know, you have to kind of, you know, pull them to come forward.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, you used the word like in coming up to testify. I don't know if it's for the record, Dave Barenberg, Legal Oregon Cities. We had one concern with the legislation, which was just more of a drafting issue as it was than I think an intent issue in terms of just who has liability and liability insurance and for the coverage. And we've been going back and forth between attorneys for the better part of a week on language, and added lots of words and just have some language that we agreed upon yesterday and has not been drafted into an amendment. We are in agreement with Chelsea on the language, and if the committee was interested in moving forward with the bill, we would have a way of taking care of it, I think, with minor language there to perfect it. And our apologies to Senator Walker for not having the amendment done, but we've had a lot of picayune discussion, or it essentially reinforced for me why it was I chose not to go to law school.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mark Landauer with the City of Portland. David is correct. The language looks like what you would, the small type of language that you would see in a leasing agreement for an automobile. We have gotten to a point where we believe we would be neutral. The effect of the language would be that the municipality and the independent contractor could negotiate who would bear the burden of carrying the insurance or defending the individual if there is a case of negligence that is brought. So with that said, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee?
Just one, Mr. Chair, in response to Mr. Landauer. So the change that I'm looking at here will allow that to be negotiated by contract, and then it'll be decided before they're ever hired to do the work.
That is correct.
Okay. And you're agreeable with that, Ms. Kaylee?
Was there any discussion with the Ask Me folks, who I think Ralph Groner represents? He asked the question, the rhetorical question, which I don't know if there was ever an answer. Anybody have any discussions with him?
I have a question.
Sure, sorry.
And this probably isn't a legal question and not an attorney, but it does beg the question. In the amendment you're considering that drafting is to negotiate who would be liable, but, you know, it's just kind of like the smell test is all I can say. I don't know that it's how a jurisdiction, a public jurisdiction, a city or county, could negotiate away liability to a private party. I mean, because a private party, you know, some big apartment building were to blow up and say, well, we made them liable, you know, we're not liable. I just would have a difficult time thinking that there would still pass the smell test that municipality would have some liability here. Just because, no, we signed our liability away. I don't know that you have a right to do that, would you?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, you know, we're following the advice of our own attorneys here that seem to believe that
that is the case. I'd love to have you be able to do that. Right?
And so I suspect that, you know, if you put it into statute, they'll be saying, look, that's what we did.
Yeah.
And we had the authority to do so, and there's the statutory authority for us
right.
to do that. And I would suspect would hopefully stand up in a court of law.
Well, and I think, Mark, you just said what Ralph was alluding to. Yeah, do you really want to do that? I mean, is to be able to take away that jurisdiction. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Is there anybody else like to testify on 831 and support or opposition? Okay, well, we'll wait for the amendments, and I think probably we should touch base with Ralph Groner just to make sure that he's, when he's, where he's sitting on this, if his questions have really been answered. So we'll close public hearing on Senate Bill 831 and not go into work session and wait for some amendments here. Open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 893. And who do we have? What's going on with this, Mr. Dawson?
Senate Bill 893 allows occupational licensing agencies to deny, suspend, or revoke occupational or professional license based on conduct that occurs outside the scope of licensed activity, but is substantially related to the fitness and ability of the licensee to engage in licensed activity. And there are amendments.
Okay, Christine. And we have Bob and David. Why don't we all come up? I think it's Bob. It's, okay, Christine. And you all seem to be in favor of this bill.
Yes. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Christine Shute. I'm with the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 893. Thank you. And in support of the -1 amendments. This committee has heard a bill that is somewhat related to this proposal before, and that bill was Senate Bill 206 that the committee passed out, and I believe it's awaiting third reading on the floor. This bill arises from the Oregon Supreme Court case Dearborn versus Real Estate Agency and the Court of Appeals case Curley versus Real Estate Agency that followed that Supreme Court case. The Senate Bill 206 that the committee's already looked at dealt with the real estate agency that licenses real estate salespeople and brokers. This bill would deal with all of the state licensing agencies. The Attorney General's office was approached by more than one agency saying, gee, it doesn't make any sense for us all to come individually before the legislature with 50-some bills to get our little statute fixed. Couldn't you please just take this on as a sort of a system-wide change? And that is why we are here. This bill, Senate Bill 893, is designed to permit licensing agencies to consider conduct of both applicants and licensees, to consider conduct that did not occur directly in the course of their practice. What that would have meant in the real estate agency cases is that the real estate agency could have considered the fact that one of its licensees had been disbarred from the practice of law, basically for dishonest real estate dealings, and could have denied that or could have revoked that person's real estate license after the person was disbarred, a result that was prohibited by the courts in its decision in that case. This bill would also permit agencies to consider conduct that had not resulted specifically in convictions, but which was otherwise proven to have taken place either through admissions or something else. And it would allow agencies to consider underlying conduct that had, say, perhaps resulted in a plea agreement with maybe many of the charges being dropped or reduced in level. This would allow agencies to make sort of predictive decisions based on a person's past conduct to decide whether the licensee was fit to practice or whether an applicant was fit to hold a license. The bill continues the current law in that it would prohibit an agency from denying or disciplining someone based simply on the fact of a conviction. The agency would be looking at what the person had actually done, not just the title of the crime. And only those activities that were substantially related to the practice that the person was engaged in would be able to be considered under this provision. You'll notice in the Dash 1 amendments that we have added a proposal to amend ORS 674.140. That statute applies to the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board, and the language that we have proposed to change was virtually identical to that language that was in the real estate agency statutes that the courts, Oregon courts, looked at. The Dash 1 amendment to change that particular statute, which is Section 2 of the Dash 1 amendment, that's sort of a belt and suspenders approach here to make sure that the appraisers board isn't stuck with the Supreme Court decision in Curley and Dearborn. I think that's all I really need to say, but I'd be delighted to hear questions.
Okay, well, let's get the rest of this.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bob Keith, members of the committee. I'm the administrator of the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board, and I'd like to submit some written testimony. We believe that the restrictions that are imposed from the Dearborn case may uniquely impact our board because the statutory provisions, as Christine just mentioned, at issue with the Dearborn case very closely mirror those of our own statute. One concern that we have as a board is that the Dearborn and Curley decisions may substantially inhibit our ability to discharge our responsibilities to the federal government with respect to effective supervision of appraisers. A real brief overview of how we came to have licensing and certification of appraisers. It came about as a result of federal legislation in 1989, which was intended to fix some of the things that caused the savings and loan crisis. Part of the blame for that crisis was faulty real estate appraisals. And so the federal government, through this act, which is the Federal Financial Reform and Recovery Act, FIREA, of 1989, was to require that all real estate appraisals are performed by those people who are qualified to do so, to establish minimum qualifications, and to require that appraisers abide by a uniform standard of professional practice. And included in that uniform standard of practice is an ethics provision which requires that all appraisers operate impartially, objectively, and independently, and also that they abstain from any criminal conduct. we believe that our ability to deny a license or to discipline an appraiser for conduct outside the scope of appraisal practice is essential in our ability to regulate and to effectively supervise appraisers. For example, if someone is convicted of perjury or embezzlement, misappropriation of funds, falsifying financial statements or something like that, may not specifically address the issue of real estate appraisal, but it's very fundamental in terms of what and who an appraiser is, which is to be ethical, neutral, and free from outside influences. So we would urge you to move this to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Koh. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Mortuary and Cemetery Board. We're one of the agencies that is affected by the Dearborn and Curley decisions, and I just had two additions. One is that I wanted to provide a concrete example of the kind of applicants and the kind of histories they have, and then I wanted to mention briefly a twist that applies to health-related licensing boards having to do with confidentiality requirements. One of the applicants that recently came before the board had this sort of a criminal history, a conviction for carrying a concealed weapon, a conviction for receiving and concealing stolen property, a conviction for theft one, burglary one, two counts of unarmed robbery and failure to appear, a conviction for possession of stolen property, and convictions for escape from a federal prison and armed bank robbery. Those are only the convictions. In reading the court documents, what you will find out is that in the one instance where this person pled guilty to two counts of bank robbery, there were actually four to six other bank robberies that were closed because this person was apprehended.
Is this an application for a mortuary license?
It's an application for what is known as a pre-need salesperson license. These are folks that sell funeral and burial arrangements in advance of the time of need, and they're funded by trust mechanisms. On advice of counsel, the board was put in a position of having to issue this applicant a pre-need salesperson license, and I think there's a reasonable expectation on the part of consumers and employers, for that matter, that when the state issues a person a license and the statute requires the board to conduct a background investigation, that a person to whom a license has been issued has, in a sense, a clean bill. In this case, that wasn't true. The board was compelled to issue the license, but beyond that, because of the confidentiality requirements that affect health-related licensing boards, we were not in a position to inform the employer that we had just issued a license to a career criminal, and that career criminal was going to be now in their employ. Not only would that person have what amounts to a key to the employer's place of business, but that applicant also, with that license, has a key to the front door of the homes of a lot of consumers in Oregon, and we're very much in support of Senate Bill 893 and urge your support as well.
Questions?
Well, just one. Mr. Coe, you're familiar with the case in Southern Oregon where we had a gentleman who had no criminal history, and he stole pre-need trust funds and went to jail for it, and then you we would allow someone with a long criminal history to come in, and that would be inappropriate, wouldn't you agree?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I couldn't agree more. Curiously, under Dearborn, since the person you're talking about committed his crime in the course of licensed activity, he could then have been denied a license for some other funeral or cemetery business. But if he had committed the same crime outside of the bounds of the activities for which the license was required, for instance, in another industry, then we would have to have given him a license despite his prison term, despite the theft of $6.5 million. We would have to issue a license, and beyond that, we could not tell the funeral home or cemetery that the person to whom we just issued a license and the person they have some confidence in as far as trustworthiness and reliability, they wouldn't know that that person was someone capable of stealing $6.5 million.
So the dash ones, you're all in agreement with those. Those solve your problems that you're concerned about. Okay, very good. Any further questions?
This is a very good bill.
Thank you. Appreciate anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 893. Now we'll close the public hearing and open up the work session on Senate Bill 893. And the chair would move the dash one amendments. Discussions, objections? So ordered. Chair moves 893 as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation. Discussions, objections? So ordered. Who wants to carry this?
I'll carry it.
All right, this could be a fun bill. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's 893. All right, we're in good shape. So we'll open up public hearing on Senate Bill 896. Is that where we're at?
Yes,
Mr. Dawson.
Senate Bill 896 modifies law governing Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association. This bill excludes from the definition of a covered claim any amount awarded as punitive or exemplary damages or statutory penalties, any amount sought as return of premium under retroactive rating plan, and any third-party claim by third-party claimant whose net worth exceeds $25 million. And there are some other caps as well. No amendments to this bill.
Welcome, Tom, and please introduce yourself.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Mortland. I chair the board of the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association. I'm here to support the passage of the bill to explain questions or issues the committee has. I might note for the record that although I chair the board and have done so for several years, the real technical expert for our group is an attorney who happens to be in London today, and our representative in this process is John Powell, who is on his way to attend his son's college graduation. So I'm filling in the gap here, and although I'm not the technician or the representative that those folks are, I'll be happy to do my best here. This is a highly technical area, and I'll try to summarize it and start at a real high level and then be prepared to go in as much detail as either I'm able or you desire. The Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association exists for one very simple purpose, and that is to pay claims, insurance claims in the property and casualty area of other insurance companies that become insolvent and go through the process of insolvency. The OIGA is essentially a creature of statute. The Oregon legislature, like legislatures in most states, created this vehicle for the payment of claims and also for the collection or the assessment and collection of funds, which are actually paid by other insurance companies. And that's the way the system has essentially operated. Over the last 3 or 4 years, due to various conditions and reasons, there have been an increased number of insurance company insolvencies in the United States. And those affect the state of Oregon. They affect claimants, consumers, insurance consumers in this state. And somewhat unfortunately, we have been in a period in the last several years of pretty high activity after some years of inactivity. In the process of encountering and seeing various issues, we have proposed this particular bill in an effort to improve the operation of the Insurance Guarantee Association in this state and also to address and deal with a series of policy issues that have come up and that we think will, if this bill passes, better enable our association to satisfy its basic purpose, consistent with the basic principle, which is to protect consumers, protect insurance consumers against the insolvency or the bankruptcy of another insurance company. So there are actually a series of 8 specific proposals here. I'm happy to go through those, again, either in summary or detail. But in general, we think it will improve the operation and help us achieve the purpose of why we exist. The first of the changes deals with punitive damages, actually excludes punitive damages. And basically, that's done because of the uncertainty and unpredictability of punitive damages. The second change is an exclusion of what are called retroactive premiums The reason for excluding that and addressing that in the bill is that retroactive premiums by nature are premiums calculated after and sometimes long after a policy period has expired. To allow or not to exclude those types of premiums creates some difficulties for us operationally, because after an insurance company becomes insolvent, we're then confronted with the possibility of claims for premiums that could extend well into the future. This is an effort to just limit the obligation in terms of those types of premium plans. The third provision, and I should mention I'm on page 2 here, line 2, sub G, capital G, refers to a net worth limitation. This legislature in the 2001 session adopted at our request a proposal that would limit the application of the guarantee fund to first-party insurance claims to claimants whose net worth did not exceed $25 million. And this extends that to third-party claims, that is, claims made against the insured of the insurance company, which has become insolvent. The basic purpose here is to focus the application of the fund and the benefits of the fund, the payment of claims to consumers in that category who are probably the least able to deal with that, and exclude those who have a high net worth. The next change is under Section 2. I'm on line 29 of page 2. And this, in through the section, lines 29 through 39, this is basically cleaning up the statutory language to clarify that the Insurance Guarantee Association, Chapter 734, applies to property and casualty type insurance and not these related types of insurance, such as mortgage insurance or insurance to protect against a failed investment, warranty, service contract type insurance, but rather the mainstream property and casualty type claims and risks that consumers are much more likely to encounter. The next change on page 3, starting in line 2, lines 2 and 3, is to restrict. This is a situation, again, in paying claims. The guarantee fund, in the case of an insolvency, has two general types of obligations. One is to pay claims. The other is to pay return premium to an insured which has already paid or prepaid its premiums, and now the company to which it's paid those premiums has become insolvent. The Guarantee Association reimburses unearned premium in that situation without restriction, except up to the limit, the $300,000 cap. This would restrict that obligation to $10,000. And again, the entities that are paying premiums, insurance premiums in excess of $10,000, typically are the larger entities that are more able to deal with that situation. This would, again, offer somewhat more protection to the to that class of claimants and insurers who are less able to face that consequence.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Mortland, what was the previous amount of the claim? Is this a new feature? This is a new feature of the bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, this is a new feature in the sense that it would limit the obligation of the association to pay unearned premium back to an insured which had, in effect, acquired credit on its premium. The cap, the general cap of $300,000 has been in place as long as the Guarantee Association has existed. That cap applies both to claims for whatever property, bodily injury, whatever the claim might be, and as the statute is currently written, it also applies to unearned premium. So in the unlikely event, it's rare that if an entity had paid premiums of $50, $100, or even up to $300,000, the insurance company to which they paid that premium is declared insolvent, then the Guarantee Association is obliged to repay that up to $300,000. So the limitation, a new feature, is that we would place a cap on that particular obligation of $10,000.
Well, Mr. Chair, what kind of company would be prepaying a premium larger than $10,000. Who's going to get the short end of the stick on this one?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker would be large insured, paying large premiums, and that is somewhat unusual, but certainly not unheard of, even in this state, for premiums. Certainly most insureds pay premiums, even small businesses, commercial entities pay premiums that are closer to this $10,000 amount than to $100 or $200. But there are insureds that pay tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of dollars in premium and may have well prepaid that or have paid that in a way that creates the situation. I'm aware of at least one situation we had, I think it was in 2001, where an issue like this was presented, where the premium, the recurring premium, was about $120,000. So there are, again, it's uncommon, but there are those situations.
So if I understand, then those people won't get any money beyond the $10,000 in the future, and so they're just going to be out the premium that they pay, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that's correct. And again, this is a policy issue that, that, in our view, is consistent with the basic purpose and reason the Guarantee Association exists, and that is the focus tends to be on the less capable insureds who don't have the ability to satisfy or be reimbursed for a loss without insurance. So again, this would hit the larger entities and pay larger premiums. So that's the type of entity that would be affected by this change.
Thank you.
The next change clarifies. It's down on the bottom of page 3 and on to page 4. Again, this is a clarification of existing rules that require a claimant, an insured, an entity, or anyone making a claim against the guarantee fund to exhaust other available insurance coverage. And that's a basic premise of how the Guarantee Association works. If there's other coverage available, first-party coverage, third-party coverage, whatever it might be, the claimants are obliged by this provision to collapse and exhaust that coverage. The particular clarification here would be to expand and make it clear that even in cases like health insurance, that coverage must be exhausted before recourse is available with the Guarantee Association. The next change is actually the deletion of language in the uninsured motorist statute, and the language deleted is on page 5. At lines 16 and 17, as currently written, the uninsured motorist statute provides that a claimant or that an uninsured motorist claim is not, and it does it by the definition of an uninsured vehicle, is not valid unless the company against which a liability claim might exist becomes bankrupt within 2 years. That creates an unnecessary limitation upon an uninsured motorist claim as it relates to this exhaustion requirement. The purpose of this change is to encourage people to go back to their own insurance company to pursue an uninsured motorist claim before they come to the Guarantee Association. It removes this somewhat artificial limitation and allows, in the situation where a claim is asserted past 2 years, which can occur, it allows the person to still pursue their own insurance company, collect from their own insurance company, and avoid having to come to the Guarantee Association. And the last change is on page 10, section 7, and establishes an aggregate limitation upon recovery from the Guarantee Association for a particular insured in the case of a particular insolvency. We have had in the last 2 or 3 years situations, this hasn't yet occurred, but we're concerned that we're getting close to it occurring, where because of a single insurance company becoming insolvent, a particular insured will have such a volume of claims of three of possible what we call cap claims, $300,000 claims, that it would literally build up into the tens of millions of dollars that we would be obliged, that the association would be obliged to pay. This creates an aggregate limitation of $5 billion, which is roughly comparable to aggregate limitations in liability policies in the insurance world, where although you may have $1 million of liability coverage, there's an aggregate limit that says you can only make two or three of those claims. You'll only have that much coverage in a given policy period. So again, the purpose is to take steps to create some reasonable limitations upon the obligation of the guarantee fund and the guarantee association to satisfy these types of claims. The assessments, as I indicated earlier, that fund, the payments of the association, are collected from other insurance companies in the state of Oregon according to a pro rata distribution based on how much coverage they write in the state. And I'm aware that there's a bill that I believe is in the House that may change that process, may change how those assessments or how the guarantee association is funded, regardless of where the money comes from. What we're proposing here is simply to read some reasonable limitations and changes in the operation of the fund, again, to accomplish what we believe will be a better achievement of its basic purpose. So I'll be happy to address any questions or concerns you have. Otherwise, I would appreciate and thank you for your support.
Thank you. Well, I was just going to say, the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association is created by statute. That's 734-550. You have a board of directors. Explain for the record again, or just give an example of how this board would function in a given case, or an example, so that I'm a little more clear about it.
Mr. Chair, the board of directors, like many boards, is the sort of the overseer, and again, we operate subject to the oversight of the insurance division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. So most of us on the board are employed in the insurance industry. I work for Liberty Northwest, North Pacific, and the Claims Department, and serve on a volunteer basis. The association itself is actually administered by a full-time administrator with currently four staff, and they operate. It's a vehicle whereby claims that are asserted against a company that becomes insolvent. I'll give you an example. The Reliance Insurance Company was declared insolvent here before last. And claims against Reliance insurers or against Reliance itself in the state of Oregon were boxed up, and there were probably a couple hundred were boxed up, taken to the Guarantee Association office. An effort was made to find out what will it take to pay those claims, and then we went ahead and assessed a pretty substantial sum of money, sent out bills to all the insurance companies that either are domiciled in Oregon or do business here, and said, pay up, we need to pay these claims for Reliance. So that's a real fairly brief example of how we operate. So it's basically a vehicle simply for collecting and spending money to pay these existing claims.
And so then this bill basically would exempt you from punitive damages if that was awarded in the case, but you'd still have to pay and clean up the insolvency.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. In the case of punitive damages, the exclusion would apply to punitive damages, but the association would still be obliged to pay compensatory damages or whatever else had been the subject of that claim.
And then this limitation is Section 7 on the last page of may not pay more than a total of $5 million. In this day and age, $5 million probably doesn't go very far, I hate to say.
Mr. Chair, that in some cases, unfortunately, is true. An example of how that might operate would be that an insured maybe a product manufacturer that was insured by insurance company XYZ had manufactured a product that caused catastrophic damage, and they were suddenly flooded with many million-dollar claims. Under the current statutory scheme, the association would be obliged to pay $300,000, assuming the claims were worth that much, repeatedly without limitation. So if there were 100 claims, we'd pay $300,000 at that many times. This would create the aggregate limitation. The aggregate limit would limit that to approximately 17 cap claims, I think, and would basically be a way of saying we'll pay but not without some limitation.
Okay.
Sorry, that's good.
Well, I'm just saying the line, Mr. Chair. So since this is new, this would be new language to the bill, so currently there is no limitation.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, there's no limitation on the aggregate amount. There is a cap of $300,000 per claim, but there's no aggregate limit. So again, in that scenario I described where there were multiple claimants against a single insured of an insolvent insurance company, the obligation that the Guarantee Association has would be unlimited. So if there were 50 claimants, we'd pay 50 times, or however many claimants there were.
Mm-hmm. So, if I could follow up, sure. Mr. Chair. Yeah. So, and you, and the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association takes all insurers, so you have casualty insurers and the like, and you know, workers' comp, everything in that. If so under this new legislation, if it were to go in as proposed here, say, for example, homeowners policies, okay, and let's say you're a Safeco, and let's say Safeco goes insolvent. In Oregon, okay. Let's hope that doesn't happen. Let's say Safeco goes insolvent, and it's one of those years of the big floods. Same time they go insolvent, we have all these floods, and you know, literally thousands of people who are Safeco or State Farm. State Farm is the biggest one, I guess. But so they have lots of claims for this, and they happen to go insolvent at the same time. So under this bill, then, as the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association, we get all these claims from the Safeco or the State Farm who went, you know, belly up, and they had these outstanding flood claims and everything else because of the unfortunate timing of the insolvency and also the claims that would be incurred. Then only $5 million total of those that company's claims would be paid out of this.
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, in that scenario, there would be no limitation upon the number of homeowners, say, whose homes have been damaged, who could still make a claim. The limitation would be, you know, to use an example, if you owned 500 homes and were the insured and happened to have all 500 homes insured with Safeco, the $5 million limit would apply to you.
Okay, so for the insured, not, okay.
Exactly.
Okay, that's important, just to clarify that. So, all right, so as long as you don't have a lot of big daddies, we're, you know, we're okay. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, that was my question too, Mr. Chair. I was a little bit concerned about that. And let me see if I can sort of read back to you what I'm thinking in my head. This organization was created by statute, and when there's a problem, then you assess all other existing insurance companies an amount of money to pay into the fund that you can then pay out. Is that how that works?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that's essentially correct.
Okay.
We have the statutory authority to assess other solvent insurance companies that do business in the state of Oregon, whether they're domiciled here or out of state and have a book of business or a percentage of the market here. But we basically calculate, send out bills when we need to assess and say, you know, Safeco pays their share and Allstate pays their share and every other carrier pays their share. We collect that money and either invest it if we have the opportunity to hang on to it. And more recently, we've been pretty much collecting and paying out because we're presented with a large volume of claims.
And, Mr. Chair, Mr. Mortland, when you assess the existing insurance companies who are solvent, is that based on the size of their company, which is, I'm sure everybody doesn't get assessed the same amount.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that's correct. It's based on the amount of business that they have in the state of Oregon.
Okay.
So although they may be a mega insurance company, if they have 10% of the business in property and casualty insurance business in this state, and we're assessing $1 million, they'll pay 10% of that $1 million assessment because that's how much of the market or the share of business they have here.
Okay. And then my final question, Mr. Chair, would be, I'm assuming you wanted to bring this bill forward because you're being assessed a high amount to solvent insurance companies and they want to lower their assessment. Is that what we're doing here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, although I work in the insurance industry, I'm trying to be careful to wear my Guarantee Association hat as I appear here today. and I can tell you that the association is fund neutral. Wearing the Guarantee Association hat, I don't care where the money comes from, and I don't care, frankly, what impact it has on the insurance industry. Rather, our job is to carry out the statute to accomplish its purpose. So I can tell you whether it lowers or increases the assessments is less the issue than trying to make sure that it serves its purpose. Frankly, the thrust of these amendments, if anything, probably tend to favor the less well-off entities or people as compared to the high-value dollars. Those are the ones, as you can see from some of these provisions, that would really be impacted. If they have a net worth above $25 million, they don't get to participate in this fund. If they have the big underwritten premiums, they don't participate. So in that sense, it could, I suppose, affect the assessments. These are not, I can't tell you that these are problems we've encountered on a regular basis. They're either issues that we've encountered or issues that we're concerned that we will encounter, such as the aggregate limitation. We haven't paid more than $5 million in that situation. Our concern is that in today's world, we may be asked to.
Well, the reason I'm asking that, Mr. Chair, is I see that the bill was sponsored by Senator Minnis at the request of John Powell, not at the request of the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association. Was that requested by Mr. Powell on behalf of the association?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I believe so, and I cannot recite accurately the detailed history. I know that there was a House bill that was drafted and presented at our request. We engaged Mr. Powell to assist us with that process, and as originally drafted, that bill did not include all the pieces that needed to be there. What happened from there, I am not sufficiently expert in the process here to know, but I know this bill was introduced very recently and was introduced at Mr. Powell's request, but that in turn was at my request and on behalf of the board and the association.
And I guess I have one final question. You indicated that the legislature created the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association. Do you know when we created that? I could probably look in the statute.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I thought you might ask that question, but I thought of it on the way down here, and I didn't check, but I believe it was 1973.
Oh,
I believe it was approximately in Oregon and in most other states. These are relatively modern creations. I won't state that with any certainty, but I believe it was approximately then.
Okay, and do you know if we've changed the provisions since the enactment of that statute, or is this, other than small little tweakings here and there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I am aware that in the 2001 session we proposed similar, what I think was largely tweaking, dealing with a bar date. We adopted a bar date, which created a time limitation. It was a so-called fade period to deal with the federal, with a U.S. Supreme Court case that changed the priorities, but it made one of the changes that I can't call to mind. But other than that, I'm not aware of prior changes, but I don't know.
And what happened to the 2001 legislation?
It was passed. It was adopted and is currently part of the statute.
Okay. All right, thank you. I promise those are my questions.
Any questions? Anything else? Tom, thank you very much for coming down. Anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 896? The committee is feeling pretty comfortable with this. Just moving on.
I'm okay.
Yeah, I'm okay. I just, I'm just a little concerned because some people are going to be on the hook, but. Like if you're over the $10,000 limit, you're on the hook. The total aggregate claims are $5 million.
Well, it sounded like it was going to be the big guy that was going to end up being on the hook.
Yeah, the big guy.
Yeah, the big dog. Yeah. Okay, well, it'd be my intent to move it if it's good with you folks.
Yeah, I guess.
Okay. Well, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 896. Open up a work session on 896, and there's no amendments. The chair would move Senate Bill 896 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Who would like to carry this one? I can take it. I'll carry it. Now I've got this race card. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2019. Mr. Dodson.
House Bill 2019A engrossed authorizes debt consolidating agencies to charge credit counseling fee when debt consolidating agency demonstrates a need for the fee. Credit counseling is required by rule or law under specified conditions, or director gives written approval to charge fee. There are no amendments to this bill.
Okay. Testimony. Ken. We finally got to you. Thank you for your great patience.
Welcome. My name is Jan Amling, and you have my testimony in front of you, and I will hit the high points of it if that's good with you instead of reading it.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm the executive director of Consumer Credit Counseling Service, which is a nonprofit agency. The Department of Consumer and Business Services has 31 licensed agencies in Oregon, or 31 agencies that have licensed in Oregon, although there are about 1,000 players out there. There's only about 31 that are licensed. The law is quite specific. ORS 697.692 is very specific about the fees that we can charge. If a person comes in for counseling, typically, if they go on a repayment arrangement program for their debts, the law allows us to charge up to $25 for a set-up fee for those people that are starting a program, and we can take up to 15% of the amount that they give us in a month for our fee, but we cannot charge them for a counseling fee. So the issue that we're trying to address, the primary issue, is to be able to have the DCBS to be able to have the authority to hear testimony and decide whether or not under some types of circumstances it might be appropriate to have a counseling fee and what the range of fees would be. For instance, if the federal bankruptcy legislation were to pass, all filers would have to go to an agency such as ours to receive counseling to find out what an appropriate what other types of solutions they have to their situation besides filing bankruptcy, and we have to set up a budget for them. At this point, we cannot charge them for that counseling. It would take those 31 licensed agencies in Oregon approximately one half FTE each to satisfy the requirements of the people that would be filing bankruptcy in Oregon, and we have no funding for it. So there could be a scenario where the DCBS would be hearing from us saying that we would like to set up fees for people that are filing bankruptcy, and those fees would be in this range. If we decided that we wanted to ask for counseling fees for people that walked into the door just for generic purposes, there might be a different fee structure for them. So what we're asking for is the DCBS to be able to have a hearing and decide what purposes we could charge and what the range of fees would be for the different types of purposes. At this point, they are already the gatekeeper on what fees we can charge for educational purposes. Right now, we can charge $5 to $10 per person per educational session. So that was something that we worked out with DCBS, depending upon the types of educational presentations we were giving and what time length they were having and what our out-of-pocket costs were. So I had an amendment added to this, and the House committee had an amendment that were added. So what you're looking at is the bill that had been modified twice before it got out of the House committee. One of them says that if a person were to be charged a counseling fee, that the person would sign a paper before the counseling session that would spell out what the maximum fee would be, and that the person knew that they could be obligated to pay that. That was one piece that was added to it. The second piece is that, unfortunately, not all the people that do this type of work are above board or being forthright with families. And the worst of the players will keep the first month's money for themselves. and this is getting families further delinquent and ruining their credit. So the other piece that we had added to this was saying that an agency would not be able to keep that monthly fee for themselves until they had dispersed funds to the creditors. So this is, Iowa is the only other state that I know of that has this type of a provision in their state law. So it's saying that you would not be able to keep that monthly fee until you had dispersed the client's monies to their creditors. So we're trying to plug that loophole that is happening with for some of the families. At this point, the funding for our agency comes from those families' programs where we are actually dispersing funds back to the creditors. One third of the families that come into our agency for counseling are actually set up on those types of payment arrangements. So basically, that one third of the families is paying for 100% of the activity in the office. The educational money that we receive doesn't really, that $5 or $10 per session does not cover our cost of education. So basically, the full funding for the agency is coming from those families that are giving us money that we turn around and send to the creditors for them. There are a number of creditors that will reduce interest for the families if they come through our program, and this is why the families are incented to come to us to get their payments to the creditors and to have their accounts re-aged.
Okay, so I mean, basically, you're a private business.
I mean, we're a private nonprofit.
Private nonprofit, so, but you have, can you be a private profit doing this?
Pardon me?
Can you be a private profit doing this?
You could.
Could be. I'm just looking at the definition, means any business that directly or indirectly does what you do in this credit. Okay, and you have this initial $25 setup, but that's not enough to...
Oh, that doesn't... Okay, but that $25 setup fee is only for that third of the families that are actually funneling money through us. So that doesn't come from the other two-thirds of the families. They're not paying anything.
And that's good. So you're asking to allow the agencies to charge a fee specified by the director...
Of DCBS.
Under specified circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
What were those circumstances again? So,
well, one would be a generic, the typical consumer credit counseling service agency in Oregon lost $3,000 last year. Our source of funding has been dwindling as the major credit grantors have been losing large sums of money with their lavish extension of credit to families that perhaps are subprime, and they're feeling the pinch, and they have been reducing the contributions that they have been giving back to agencies for helping families. So it's conceivable that we would want to ask all the families that come in the door for a $10 contribution or some such. The other circumstance would be if bankruptcy legislation passes. We would have a burden of obligation of maintaining records for, I'm not sure what the government's going to require, 7 years. Sometimes they require them to be in fireproof vaults. We have to issue certificates to those families to give to the court before the papers can be filed saying that they've had this counseling. So there's more of a burden that we have with those families.
Okay, so you would have to put in writing the maximum amount that you could charge.
Right.
And you said $10, but I mean, could it be $1,000?
No, because DCBS would have set what that range would be.
Yes.
So if the maximum we could charge, the average of those states in the United States that do have counseling fees, the average is $26.
Okay.
The maximum that any of the states has charged that I've been able to find is 50. But so DCBS may say, okay, we'll allow you to charge $25 for anybody that walks in the door, but if you're going to do bankruptcy counseling, the maximum you could charge is 95.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that we weren't talking about uncontrolled. He said, I was for Senator Byers, but any questions?
Yes.
Okay,
thank you. Ms. Amling, I remember seeing you before. Did you have something similar to this last session?
We did. It was a rather convoluted bill that got bogged down with a variety of different types of amendments, and it died.
I remember it was a real complicated bill. Problems with it.
There were some misunderstandings too about why we didn't do settlements, and there were a whole variety of issues
in it.
which is
take
not...
Take that out of it. This isn't part of these bills.
It never was, even 2 years ago. But there was some misunderstanding by, I think, some committee members that thought we should be doing settlements and didn't understand why we couldn't be doing them. And
yeah,
it's something.
Yeah, Representative Merkley had some questions. It's starting to come back to me now. As you know, the bankruptcy legislation is still stalled in Congress. And hopefully it'll stay there for a while. I have some significant problems with that legislation, but in order for you to be available, should that legislation pass, in order for you to be able to accommodate all these people, you really need this enabling legislation in order to not be a completely nonprofit free agency, basically, because, I mean, you're nonprofit, but that doesn't mean you do your services for free, and that's kind of what you're being asked to do in some of these circumstances, isn't that true?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. Questions? Thank you very much. Anybody else like to testify upon this? We do have a note here from Representative Betsy Close that said that she would like to have testified on this, and her written testimony indicates that she's asking for an aye vote. And since this is the last meeting, I think the committee is such a mind. Do you have any problems with this?
No, I think it's a good bill, Mr. Chair. As I indicated, we did discuss this last session in the House Business and Labor Committee that I served on, and I'm familiar with these agencies, and I think the fees being set by rule by DCBS will offer protection to consumers that they're not fees so high that they can't take advantage of these services. I actually think it's a good bill.
Okay, very good. So we'll close public hearing and open up a work session. If we're in good shape, open up a work session on House Bill 2019A, and there are no amendments. It's already been amended, so Chair would move House Bill 2019 as amended in the House to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Representative Close wants to raise fees. I'm happy to go.
Okay.
And probably is fortunate that Senator Beyer isn't here since they're being set in by rule, and we know he doesn't like that.
That's
a good day for the representative.
We'll ask the Representative Close to talk with Senator Beyer if you would please do that, so we don't have any trouble on the floor with this. Okay, so if there's no objection, so ordered, and this is just a milestone. It truly is. So Senator Walker will carry that, and we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2331. Finally, we've just cleared out the whole House.
I've been here before.
Because
we had so much fun.
The accountancy talk is now returned.
It's so mind-numbing that you really don't want to take it on earlier.
Thank you, Carol, for being patient.
Yes, Carol, you've cleared the room.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, Vice Chair Walker, Mr. Metzger, very much for hearing House Bill 2331, and we urge you to help us move it forward. House Bill 2331 deals with the reciprocity provisions for certified public accountants. It amends ORS 673-040, which is the statute that is the general licensing authority for certified public accountants. House Bill 2331 has four different provisions.
Take your name real quick.
Oh, thank you. I'm Carol Reeves, and I am the administrator for the Board of Accountancy.
We know who you are, Ms. Reeves, but
the tape doesn't.
Thank you.
I'll be brief with the four provisions. The first two have to do with reciprocity. The last two address public protection. The first one causes me to blush. It restores authority for the board to issue reciprocal licenses, which was inadvertently omitted or deleted, rather, from the statute during the last legislative session. And we did not notice it until we were long gone.
Was that one of those huge bills?
It was. We did something else with that provision, and in the end, reciprocity was gone. And we realized we were issuing reciprocal licenses willy-nilly as they came forward without authority to do so. Our legal counsel said not to do. So reciprocity is important, as you can understand, for a couple of reasons.
for folks coming into our state, without these provisions, they would be required to meet the current standards for licensing, which is 150 hours, including a degree, and retake the CPA examination. And certainly they don't want to do that. But equally important is for our own licensees. Many states will not reciprocate with a state that does not itself offer reciprocity. And so we could possibly be denying our licensees from the ability to practice across state lines because we don't offer reciprocity to other licensees. And I'm sure you understand, and I don't have to elaborate on the interstate nature of the practice of accountancy. It is not something that is confined to the parameters of each state. So it is a practice that you will find folks working in more than one state and having a license in more than one state.
How do you define a chartered accountant?
And that is the next provision. Chartered accountants, this is the corollary to a CPA in some European countries, primarily Great Britain, Canada, some African countries, Australia, New Zealand. The requirements for a chartered accountant in each of these countries is not necessarily the same. There have been reciprocal licensing agreements negotiated with some of those countries between our professional association, the National Association of State Boards of Accountancy, familiarly known as NASBA, with some of these countries so that states may offer, if they choose to, reciprocal licenses to those that have been approved. Four countries have been approved. Canada, New Zealand, Australia, they've been working on Great Britain and haven't gotten it across. We have the same question there as we do with reciprocity. Our licensees may wish to practice in Canada if we have a reciprocal licensing agreement with that country, then they will honor the reciprocity of our CPA. If we don't honor the agreement, then they do not have to honor our licensees. These agreements, in order to meet the standards of the agreements, those folks have to have certain licensing requirements that have been deemed to be equivalent to those that we require in the United States. So we think that this is an important provision for us to have the authority to do. It does not mandate the board to do this. It allows them to do so if they choose. The last two provisions are pretty short and sweet. They relate directly to public accountancy, or protection of the public, rather. The first one amends the requirements for supervising licensees by requiring a minimum licensing period before the supervision of an applicant is counted or is eligible. And I have to explain this a little bit. There is an experience requirement after you take the CPA exam before you may become licensed. Depending on what program or when you're entering the track, you might have 1 year of experience or 2 years of experience that you must certify before you are eligible for licensing. And the experience requirement under the CPA laws is a very strict one. A supervising licensee must attest to your competency in 7 separate areas that are deemed to be essential to competency in the practice of public accountancy. And we believe that the supervising licensee must be equally competent if he's going to be attesting or certifying to a younger person's competency. And for that reason, the board thinks it's important for him to have, for that licensee, to have been licensed with this board or another state board for a minimum period of time so that his competency is established in order to certify it. That goes to public protection. And the second one does it as well. It requires that any candidate or applicant for a license must have obtained all of the requirements for eligibility within a specific time period. In this case, probably 8 years. So that means if your exam is more than 8 years old, you would have to retake the exam. If your experience was obtained more than 8 years prior to the date of application, you would have to reestablish your experience requirement. And the purpose of that is to make sure that you have currency in the standards and the skills that are necessary for public accountancy. It goes straight to public
protection. Is that 8 years in the statute, or is that in this bill, or is that just a
It will be in administrative rule. The time period will be determined by rule.
You think it's going to be 8 years?
I surely do. Those are the provisions, and we certainly appreciate your hearing us and would appreciate your support of this bill. I would appreciate any questions. Be happy to help.
Questions?
Where's my questions?
So we accidentally deleted the reciprocity 2 years ago, okay?
Yes, sir.
And that's a common thing that was used, right?
Yes, sir.
So what's been happening the last 2 years? Have you been cheating? Or
we've
have
been
you
cheating.
Been turning people down?
No, we have been cheating.
We were not.
You brought us.
we were not even aware of this until July, which it was past the period when we could bring our own bill to correct the situation. And in fact, we. I went on hands and knees to Representative Butler to see if he would bring the bill on our behalf. Council noticed it in the course of some investigation or some search of our statutes. She said, something strange is going on here. What's happening? And she recognized that I think it was around July or August of last summer. We had been issuing them. We continue to issue them. All of the rules have been in place always, you know, for reciprocity. So the rules are out there to give notice to the public of what the requirements are. It's just that the authority kind of slipped away for that two-year period.
I see some fodder for the weekly.
Well, I was just thinking, Mr. Chair, you know, if the based on our previous bill that Carol brought before us about the audits division and the license,
yes,
there, you know, perhaps if,
yes,
the audits division had looked over their legislation, we would have caught this.
Exactly. Representative Butler was kind enough to also throw an emergency clause in the bill so that it will become effective upon signature, which will get us out of the, you know, embarrassing situation a little bit sooner than otherwise. Without the bill, or should the bill pass, there is no fiscal impact. Without the bill, it costs the board about $40,000 a year in revenue from reciprocity.
Very good.
But it's the fee lowering bill then, right?
Well, yeah.
It would be. We'll bring you one of those next term.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
We'll Mr. Chair.
Close public hearing on 3120 or 31, House Bill 2330. Open up work session, House Bill 2331 with no amendments. Chair would move House Bill 2331 forward with a due pass recommendation. Discussions. Objections.
I don't want them to be cheating anymore.
Yeah, we want this to be there. So, okay, no objections. So ordered. And
I just sent a rubber band flying.
No, I thought this something came out of any. I guess I can carry
no,
it.
No, you
want?
Can't, Mr. Chair. Oh. You got two, I get two.
All right. Senator Walker would love to carry that bill. So good, and this.
It's so sneaky the way you work that.
Yeah, I know. I just tried to slip that one. What I understand is that we will be having a meeting with the chairs of all committees on Monday to discuss the reopening of committees with these bills, and so we'll. Until that occurs, we will adjourn the Senate Committee on Business and Labor until further call. Thank you very much for all your good work. Thank you.